Hello, my name is Debbie Boone, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, The Bend, where we explore how successful people navigated the path and emerged in a better place when life threw them an unexpected twist. It's inspired by one of my favorite sayings, the bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the curve. These conversations will hopefully help you and inspire you to embrace your personal bend and to flourish. I hope you enjoy it, and if you need help with your own personal navigation and you're in veterinary medicine, please feel free to reach out to me at Debbie Boone, 2Manage Vets Consulting. Enjoy the bend and be inspired by our wonderful guest. Welcome. All right, welcome everyone to today's episode of The Bend. So today, my guest is Dr. Craig Pryor, and I met Craig as the facilitator of a VMG group that had invited me to come and speak. But previously, he was the owner of Murphy Road Animal Hospital, which was an 8-doctor practice in Nashville, which is where he is now. He was the partner in 3 emergency hospitals in Middle Tennessee. And he's been doing this more than a minute, right? Like 39 years. I can relate to that. My first job was in 1985 as a part-time receptionist. But Craig was born in Australia, went to Queensland in Brisbane for his veterinary degree. So our challenge today, Craig, is between my Southern accent and your Australian accent and making sure everybody can understand what we are talking about today. But thank you very much for coming on this episode of The Bend.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you having me on. And I did bring a translator if we need one. So they're standing by and ready.
Sounds good. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, how you ended up with an 8-doctor practice, because I have managed practice that grew like that. And quite honestly, sometimes it's a roller coaster ride of hanging on for your life at some point in time. But tell me a little bit about, you know, how you started in practice and what got you to the United States, I guess.
Well, what got me to the United States was a girl. I took a year off when we're allowed to take gap years when we're at university. I took a gap year because I just got really burned out. And I figured that better to take a gap year than probably fail, because I wasn't really caring much about anything. So I took a year off, wanted to travel. I applied for a job, and I was one of 24 people chosen to represent Australia at the 1982 World's Fair in Knoxville, Tennessee. So spent 6 months representing Australia there, 6 months traveling, met a girl while I was in Knoxville. We started going out together. We started a long distance relationship. So consider this, no cell phones, no internet. We had the means to communicate was you could make a $6 a minute landline phone call. You could write a letter that took 10 to 14 days one way, or you could buy a really expensive airplane ticket to fly across the world. And we did that for 2 years.
Oh my gosh.
Then we got married, and I graduated and moved over here. Went through the ECFG program in its infancy, which was an absolute nightmare. The first thing that they wanted me to do was take English speaking lessons for 6 months and sit for an English speaking exam, because they were not aware that in Australia we speak English. Literally, we're not aware that we spoke English in Australia.
That's insane.
Yes, it was. I got some rules changed in the program to help people after me. Long story short, I finally got my license to practice over here, and all's good. And I joined a practice as an associate. And after a couple of years, I was offered a partnership. It was a junior partnership. And, you know, I'll say that my partner and I were very, very, very well aligned on how to practice veterinary medicine. How to practice veterinary medicine, how to take care of clients, how to take care of patients. So I was a partner with him for many years, and then finally bought him out, and the practice was mine, and then continued to grow the practice. And then VCA came along and made me an offer that was just, you know, like many others of my age group, the markets just went bananas, and it's hard to say no, right? And yes. I was ready. So I sold the practice, but I still have, 39 years of experience. I've got a lot to offer veterinarian still and veterinary community still. So I want to stay involved. I was a VMG member when I owned my practice, and the VMG network asked me to stay on as a facilitator, which I did. I do a lot of speaking for different companies, do a lot of consulting for different companies and for a lot of private veterinarians. And I do practice sales as well. So my friends started calling me up and saying, hey, I need out, help me. So I do.
Yeah. That practice transition, I think that is, that really is challenging. I have a couple of practices that I work with and we talk about that. We talk about what is your strategy for exit? And one of the guys is kind of young and he went, you know, I was a little offended when you said, how am I going to exit myself out? But then I started thinking about it and I went, well, I've always told young practitioners when I help them with startups that it is important to start planning your exit the day you unlock the doors and open your own hospital, because it is a strategic plan. And that has to do with how you manage the bookkeeping. And I'm sure that if you are helping people sell their practice, if you are looking in their books, you are seeing probably what I see is that it's horrendous bookkeeping and the garbage that goes in is almost has to be sorted and cleaned up before a sale can be made, because there's no data that will prove how much the value of the practice is worth until you get the books cleaned up.
If you don't, you're not going to get the value that the practice is worth. No. Because no. You know, what I tell veterinarians is, you know, they hide all kinds of stuff in their books, right? It's like, it's just
the creative accounting.
Yes, human nature. I don't care what you've hidden in there. Just be able to show me where it is. I need to be able to point to it.
Exactly.
You know, because every cent, you know, every dollar you find, you know, is worth 10x.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, it's the difference between being able to retire with a mediocre lifestyle or retire well.
Right, right. Well, I think sometimes that practices think that they're being sly by hiding things like, you know, personal income or personal, like their cell phone or their housekeeper or those things. Well, that's okay. We can pull those out when you're starting to look at normalizing. But the problem is in this market, when we've seen practice sales at 25 times EBITDA, so every dollar that you can't put down to the profit line is really $25. Mm-hmm. And that 38 cents that you're saving by not paying taxes on it is inconsequential compared to the $25 that you might get when you get ready to sell it. And so it's just a...
And a lot of vets, you know, say to you, well, I'm not ready to sell today.
Right.
That's fine. You don't have to. No one's asking you to, but life happens, or death happens, or divorce happens.
Yes.
And you know, something hits you out of left field and you have no choice. Well, then, you know, you need to think about that on day one when you open your business up.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've had my own personal experiences managing a practice. And of course, I grew up in a family business and I grew up surrounded by business, which is not, you know, always common in veterinary medicine. But I can remember my practice owner only had his name on his personal checking account. And that there was a reason for that. His wife, he didn't want her spending the money, right? He was controlling. I said, but if you die, none of us can get paid because I'm a signature on the business. I said, but your wife can't even write a check, you know, for your funeral. So you've really got to straighten this out. And, you know, he was reluctant, but he did it. But these are things that you have to think about if you're not here, if you're not able, if you're, you know, disabled, then somebody's got to step in there and somebody's got to know what's going on and how to fix that and how to move forward. You know, what would be the strategic plan with your business if you became disabled? And those are things that people need to think about, but nobody likes to think. It's like writing a will, right?
Yeah. Well, I actually, yes. So, you know, for those of you out there without wills, get one today.
Yes.
My wife's cousin just unexpectedly died 2 months ago. And he was taking care of his elderly mother. He left no will. And now, the family asked me to help them out. I had to step in. For the last 2 months, I've been doing forensic accounting and, playing Where's Waldo, trying to find all the assets that were hidden everywhere so that we could then get the elderly mother into assisted living to have her taken care of.
Oh my gosh.
I succeeded, but it makes it, instead of a 2 month process, it would have been a 1 week process if there'd been a will.
Right, exactly. And I'm a cancer survivor, and so when I was 46, I was diagnosed with cancer, and I got a will, and I've had a will ever since. And so I think these are important things to do. Even people say, "Well, I don't have anything." Yeah, you do. And you do, especially if you are a business owner or you are a partner in a business, there needs to be a strategic plan for what happens if you no longer exist, or the other thing.
And translate that to the practice and the value of the practice. I made myself redundant. So many veterinarians that own practices, that's where you get yourself worth from, is that I'm a practice owner. This is my practice. I built this baby. That's great. Congratulations. I'm all for that. But, if you are the whole personality of that practice, you can't leave. If you sell, you have to stay on 3 years minimum, some of them even longer, because they then have to find a way to replace you and replace the personality that's there. I made sure with all my doctors that my doctors were on buddy systems. And my, doctors were, well, these are my clients. No, they're not. They're the practice's clients. But you need to remember, you don't work 7 days a week. You're not here 24 hours a day. If you want to have a weekend off, if you want to have vacation, someone else has to feel, your client has to feel comfortable with another doctor. So you're going to have a buddy system, and you're going to make sure that every time you got a complicated case, that your buddy has stepped into the exam room and said hi to that client and said to them, I know that Dr. Jones is your primary vet, but she's off tomorrow. I'm here to answer any of your questions. And so that's important. But also, if you are the owner of the main personality, make yourself redundant. Otherwise, last thing I ever want to do is die in an exam room, right? I don't want to be 93 years of age and in the exam room and keel over. Oh, shoot me, right?
Oh no. Well, in my first practice owner, I managed the hospital for 19 years. And the last 6 months before he retired, he didn't even work there. He established a residency in Florida so that when he sold his practice to one of our associates, he didn't have to pay income tax on the sale profit because he moved to Florida. So these are strategic plans. But you're right. One of the things, especially we're thinking about like new doctors who are coming in, I've often questioned the reasonableness of new doctors coming in when owners won't let them do anything, and they don't take them into those exam rooms and give their blessing to this new doctor with the existing clients. Because when you do that, that's one of the things we always did, was introduce those new doctors. The existing doctors would come in and say, "Hey, I want you to meet this new doctor. They're great. If I'm not here, this is who's going to take care of your animal." And it's not just the random event that they have to find out that there's somebody else taking care of their pet. This is a planned strategy that they know everybody in the practice and they're comfortable with everybody and the team, because it is not just about the doctor, it is about the entire team giving great service and creating and bonding the clients to the practice. We need to be that team focused, client focused, group, rather than the veterinary centric focused that we have in a lot of practices. And granted, in today's hiring, there's practices who would love to have more than one doctor, but they can't find another one. Some of the rural practices. Are you seeing some of that in your work?
I'm out on the road a lot, and every time I do a meeting, I always ask, who's fully staffed? The interesting thing is this year, there'll be, 1,500 people in the room, and you may get one or two hands go up. I'm starting to see more hands go up.
I'm seeing
and,
it.
And I see that the, I think we are going to get out of this labor crisis we're in. And I think that we're actually going to end up with an oversupply of veterinarians, which is going to damage our profession as well. Yeah.
So this is a good question for us to delve into, because, you know, we are seeing a great shortage of veterinarians according to workflow, but it was all a very skewed, inefficient workflow during COVID. And granted, a lot of people went to do telehealth and a lot of people went to do multitudes of other things, relief work and things like that. And some just plain left the profession. But I feel like there are, like you said, I think we've been to the valley and we're starting to work our way back up the mountain again to where we can see and breathe again. But I also see that the demand from the public is diminishing some too. We're seeing that in some of the data that we're...
I went to a friend's practice yesterday, and, you know, they're one of the busier practices in Nashville area. And I said, you know, seems quiet. And she said, yeah. She said, we only have 2 appointments on the books today.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa, right? There's a first for you. It's starting to change. But, you know, and the workflow, it's all around workflow. I mean, you know, I truly don't think we really haven't had a shortage of veterinarians. We haven't had a shortage of staff. We've had an inability to work efficiently, which has really driven that. So the solution has always been, well, hire more people. And, you know, when you're getting, when you look at it, and, you know, I actually pulled out some data that I had, because I used to track everything in my practice. And, you know, they say that we've got about 3-to-1 ratio of, you know, paraprofessionals to professionals, and, you know, less than that actually right now. I used to run about 4.7.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it just, I didn't need as many vet, you know, you don't need as many veterinarians when you've got very efficient staff around those veterinarians.
No.
And so do we need as many veterinarians as they're saying we do? I mean, you know, look at that AVMA study said we need, you know, we'll be 15,000 short by 2030. And Mars actually says we'll be 50,000 short by 2030. I disagree with that. I think that, I think we're going to have an oversupply because we're going to go from 33 vet hospitals, 33 vet schools up to 45 vet schools, and they're doubling enrollment in most of them. You know, it's going to create an oversupply of veterinarians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which will drive down wages,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, we'll see student loans then go up again because, you know.
It's always a seesaw. Of course, you and I, we have been through the 2008-2009 Great Recession in working in practice. And it did slow down. And at that point, AVMA was saying we have too many veterinarians. I think probably we just need to quit talking about how many we have and work with the ones that we have, because we do need them and we need them in various roles.
And we've turned the veterinary profession into a part-time profession.
Exactly.
And that may absorb some of the excess because we'll continue to be more a part-time profession.
Yes.
But I want to be full-time.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happened in the 2008-2009. They didn't really anticipate the fact that the model where a veterinarian would work a 60-hour work week was not going to work for a millennial generation who went, that's nuts, and said, I'm going to work a 30-hour work week and be, you know, satisfied with that, but I still want the pay that I was going to get for the 60-hour work week, and probably more than that. But it takes twice as many bodies to do it that way. And we have to understand, and especially with the majority of women that we have, there's always somebody out, right? Pregnant. We always have to anticipate and plan for maternity leaves. And we probably should be planning for longer maternity leaves than what we do, because it would be better for our staff. But, you know, we are very feminine profession. In fact, I had 2 male veterinarians apply for a job I'm trying to help one of my clinics with. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so shocked that I have 2 guys that have applied.
Yeah. I mean, people react negatively to this statement, but it's true. Men in veterinary medicine, they're a minority now.
They are. Yeah, they are.
That's just the fact. They are the minority. So when you find them, they're like, oh.
Really? Whoa. Surprised. I was surprised. Well, I think this is going to be a really interesting next 5 years. I'm curious to see the new vet schools, the graduation of the first groups that are coming through those schools, especially the ones who are doing the experiential training where they are actually in clinics and working in rather than sort of the teaching hospital, because they're sending them out into the world. And of course, I feel like I'm seeing through my long experience some places that are doing this kind of work that are doing a great job. They're mentoring these students, they're teaching them things. Other ones them are using them for a cheap labor or slave labor. And then you have that. So are they really learning? And that I think that we'll have an interesting a learning curve here to see how that works.
Correct. It all depends where they place them. Are they good hospitals? Do they have good people there that are willing to mentor them, right, to teach them up or not? Or, are they just getting in the way? And
Right.
so they're not going to leave with as much experience as they want.
Yeah.
And we're losing my generation that are all retiring because they got such crazy multiples for their practices. So they're able to step out and say, I'm done, I'm retired. But we were the ones, we're the extrovert generation. I mean,
Yes.
yes, we're boomers, but we're the extrovert generation. And as a veterinarian, as a small animal clinician, it's a people business. That's right. That's what I always talk to when I have students talk about wanting to go into veterinary medicine. I talk to counsel and I said, this is, you may think you're going to go play with animals. You're not. It's a people business. It's all about communicating well with the client, because if you don't, it's the communication with the client that then just decides what you get to do to the animal.
100%.
So it's communication first, then it's veterinary medicine second. So you better be a good communicator. You better be someone that can actually, interact with these people and engage them. And extroverts always do better.
Yeah. Well,
Who do you
it's
think I
funny.
am as they retire? And they're the ones we need to be mentoring these young pups right now.
They do. They need to be teaching them those communication skills. Well, it's funny that you mentioned that because a couple of days ago, somebody made a question, asked a question on an AHA lister, and it was, what do you think is the most important thing for success as a veterinarian? And multiple answers were good communication, good communication. And so I popped in there and I said, okay, so you got all unanimously said that communication was really important. What communication training have you taken or have you given to your team? And the answers were, well, really none. We didn't take any formal classes on communication. We all believe it's really important, but we're not training our teams. We're not training, we're not learning ourselves to do that. So my bandwagon is I believe that communication training should be mandatory to maintain your veterinary license and your technician license. Because unless it becomes mandatory and part of your required CE, they will never take it because people are not self-aware that they are not good communicators.
90% of all issues I've ever seen in practice is not from what we do. We know what to do. We know how to do it. It's from what we say, what we don't say, or how we say it. It's all around communication. In fact, I've got a friend in California who says sits on the California board out there, and he says that California board, when they look at all the complaints that are brought up there, 10% of true malpractice, 10% of the drugs are alcohol or alcohol related. Everything else is communication related.
100%.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I was actually just speaking the other this week in Indianapolis, and I actually had a veterinarian that used to work for me many years ago. It was wonderful to catch up with her. It's just great when you see veterinarians and where they've gone in life, and she's just so successful now. And she actually turned to me and she said, and she said, one of the things, so she started working for me when she was not straight out of vet school, but fairly new out of vet school. She said, that was one of the greatest things you ever did for us, was that you actually used to teach us how to communicate with the clients, and you used to have scripts with up for us that we would help us understand how to recommend something, how to recommend parasiticides or recommend dentistry, you put together these scripts that you just gave us that were just like, here's how you do it. This is how an extrovert gets to communicate to the client and gets them to do what they want. And she goes, we're all introverts. We don't want to do this. And you spoon fed us. And she said, it just helped us do so well.
Yeah. And then you have success, and then it becomes easier to do it the next time and the next time and the next time, because yeah. You've practiced it and you've gotten good at it, and people are saying yes. And so there's a positive reinforcement for being able to communicate well. You know, it's funny, if you talk to veterinarians about sales skills, they will faint and fall over. And if you teach them sales skills, they're better veterinarians because they get to actually do the work they know how to do. And there's this negative connotation. We're not talking about being a used car salesman. We're talking about education. And that really is, this is kind of leads me into the CAPC stuff, Craig, because I love CAPC. I love the data that it has. And I feel like we don't use it enough in using it to sell clients, because there's such good data down to the county you live in about what diseases are out there, what you need to look for. I just actually looked this up before I got on here with you and found out that the county that I live in, or the state of South Carolina, has seen an incidence of canine influenza two counties over. And so now it's time, I've got to go get my dog vaccinated. He's just now due, but you know, it encourages me to be on time with that vaccine more so than it would have, because he's a house dog and there are no dogs around us. But those are such important tools. So tell me a little bit about your work with CAPC. And for those of you who don't know what this is the Companion Animal Parasite Council, vet.org, CAPCvet.org. Great source of information.
So let me, if I can, let me share my screen.
Yeah, let me give you permission.
And but let me just reiterate just what you just finished before we went to CAPC about being salesman. I absolutely agree with what you said. At the end of the day, I feel that everyone needs to understand that veterinarians are all salesmen. Yes. We sell one thing. It's called knowledge, how best to repair a torn ACL, how to work up a cat with liver disease, or what parasiticides are in your best interest for you to use. And that's why the clients are paying to come to us.
Yes.
To get our knowledge. Okay, so I have opened up the front page of CAPCvet.org. Okay, so CAPCvet.org is your go-to place. This is the opening page. So CAPC, we are a international nonprofit. We are funded by industry. We keep ourselves independent from industry, though. Our board members are made up of practicing veterinarians like myself, preeminent parasitologists, public health veterinarians, and some other people. We've got a professor of statistics. We've got a technician, things like this, that all fill duties on the CAPC website, on the CAPC board. So the what is our mission? Our mission is to see every pet tested and every pet protected, full stop. That's what we're here for. And you know, we want to engage owners and provide guidelines for veterinarians and resources. And, you know, just to drive that whole, to see every pet tested, every pet protected. Should we achieve that, we can pack our bags and go home. I don't think we ever will get to that point, but we're going to strive to do that every day that we're in existence. So, you know, and how, what's our engagement strategy? It's that parasites are dynamic and ever changing. Of course, we know that they are, and they're on the move. So what I'll show you firstly, on the front page here, that you can see my cursor, I'm on guidelines. Here's our guidelines. We have all the common parasites of dogs and cats and the less common parasites of dogs and cats. They're all listed alphabetically by common name and scientific name. So everything you need there. So these guidelines are written by parasitologists. They're reviewed, the guidelines are reviewed by a board of parasitologists. And once they're approved, then we publish them and then we update them on an ongoing and regular basis. So if I go here and I say, let's go down to Ehrlichiosis, and it's Ehrlichiosis and Anaplasma together, we've then got this whole guidelines written by the parasitologists, and we update them on an ongoing regular basis. But you've got everything you need, synopsis, you've got the stages, you've got the disease, you've got the prevalence, you've got the diagnosis, you've got the treatment. It's all here for you. And there's your reference. So we are basically the place to go should you have any questions. The other thing we do is we do mapping. So we've been mapping since 2012, and you click here to go to our maps. So when you look at our maps, I have this on intestinal parasites, roundworms, dog, okay? I can choose cat. I can choose hookworms, roundworms, whipworms, Giardia. I can go back here. I can choose heartworms. And there's heartworms for a cat, feline heartworm antibody, feline heartworm antigen. And then there's canine heartworms. And then I can go to tick-borne agents. And we've got Lyme, Anaplasma, Ehrlichia. And we also have viral diseases. We've got feline leukemia and feline AIDS. And why do we have those? Because we believe, so because we're the mapping experts and we've been asked to. And so, yes, we do what we can. And a lot of people believe that immune suppressed cats get more parasites. Well, if we can publish data that people that can use to reference, then maybe we can see some papers come out of that and we'll see a relationship there. And so that's all about improving that. You can also go to Canada. We've got Canada up here as well. Okay. So we're going to go to, I've got this on intestinal parasites, roundworms, dog. I've got it by the year, or you can go by the month. And then we show you the prevalence percentage. And this is, shows you also 1 in 50 dogs in the United States is infected with roundworms. It's all big data. So over 9 million tests, we've got big data. This is metadata. We're pulling from IDEXX, Antech, and Zoetis.
All right, that's big companies.
And also, if you do patient-side tests, depends what you're running, depends which test and things like that, we can pull some patient-side tests as well, but not all of them. So we are pulling some of those as well. You can print these maps off. Why do you want to print them off? Well, you can use them in the exam room. You can use them at the front desk. It's engagement strategy. You know, we have to find ways to engage our clients. You know, the average client's walking to a vet clinic 1.9 times a year. The average client walks into a big box store about 3 times a month. Where do you think they're getting their information from? It needs to be from us. So you can print these out for use there, or you can get updates. And if you click here and get updates, you'll set up an account with us, and then you'll choose your state and county or counties of interest, and then your parasites of interest, and we'll send you monthly updates. So I got an email in my inbox the other day that said in Williamson County, Tennessee, where I am, we had 2 cases of Lyme. We're not a big Lyme area. It's oozing into our area. But we had 83 cases of Ehrlichiosis, 102 cases of heartworm. So what do? We get on our social media. We engage our clients. We tell them the facts. Hey, you know, one in, you know, in this case, we're roundworms. Well, if I went to heartworms and I go to, I'm just going to show you where I am. So I'm down here in Williamson County. You know, we got 1 in 200 dogs showing up positive, right? And so you can now put that in. If you so just say, let's just change that and say you're getting 1 in 20 dogs walking in the door with heartworm, okay? If you've got a 3-doctor practice, you're seeing an average of 15 patients a day. That's you're seeing 2 patients a day. So that's 45 patients a day with 3 doctors. If 1 in 20 dogs is positive in your county for heartworms, you're seeing 2 a day with heartworms. That's the engagement. You can you're related to what clients are concerned about what's going on in their backyard. So tell them what's going on in their backyard and say, if this concerns you, come talk to us.
But also talk to your team. I think this is the other thing
Yes.
that we miss because
Correct.
I can tell you my CSRs were excellent at talking to clients about what was going on and what we had seen. Especially, I mean, we rarely in my hospital, we had a great clientele who was extremely compliant. In fact, that's how I got my start as a speaker, was talking about my compliance rate. But we rarely saw any heartworms, but we always tested for heartworms and parasites. And then when the 4Dx came out, we tested for tick-borne diseases routinely. And we actually diagnosed a dog with Lyme in North Carolina, and this was in 2006 when it had not come to the state of North Carolina. And the client had been sick for 2 years, undiagnosed. But when we tested the dog with the 4Dx test, found out it had Lyme, she went back to her personal physician and said, "Hey, my dog is positive for Lyme. Maybe we should test me." Sure enough, that's what she had had for 2 years, and the it wasn't on the radar. So I think this is why this is really important for
And then
all
you
team members to know this stuff. We need to know what's in our world. And people travel with their animals so much. We can't just say, oh, we don't have heartworm. We don't have Lyme. We don't have this. animals are everywhere that people go. And most hotels now are pet friendly. The whole Sheraton chain is. And we have to realize that these animals are going everywhere that humans travel. And they are picking up diseases that are not in our backyard typically, but we have to have awareness. And I think this really helps us be aware.
The team needs to be asking clients, where did you travel this year? And did you take your pet? Mm-hmm. And then you need to say, where do you plan on vacationing next year? And are you taking a pet? When they say yes, then you go to where they are going on vacation. You see what the risks are and then change mm-hmm. your parasiticide strategy and your vaccine strategy accordingly. Mm-hmm. The other thing I teach my teams are look at it over time. So you talk about North Carolina. I brought up Lyme in 2012 in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So let's look at 2014. And look at the map slowly turning red.
Yes.
Right. And what we're seeing is movement of the black-legged tick and with it Lyme disease into North Carolina. And you see it's just slowly lighting the map up as it moves into an area. So a lot of people say, well, it's not in my area. Well, if you don't look, you won't find.
Exactly right.
And it's all about awareness. And, you know, more so even West Virginia's classic example. If I look at West Virginia in 2012, look at the map. There's almost no red there. And I look at it 2022. Yes. It's now almost all red.
Yes.
Right. Yes. So it went from 2022. It went from 1 in 20 dogs showing up positive for Lyme. In 2022, it's 1 in 6 showing up in Lyme. And we also know, and this is the other thing I teach my teams, is that the dogs are sentinel for the risk of human infection. So 1 in 6 dogs are showing up positive for Lyme disease. 1 in 6 humans are at risk of developing Lyme as well. Wow. In that county or in that state.
Yeah. And this is where we're talking about One Health. And I think this is where it's so important that there's a collaboration between veterinary medicine and human health. Because I can tell you, there has been a lot of incidents where our veterinarians were aware of these diseases and people have parasitic infections and things like that, that the human physicians, it's never on their radar. And you need to make them aware, especially if you are a worker in the animal health industry and you have some mystery illness that your physician cannot figure out. Make sure that they know what you do for a living, because we are at risk more so than the general population working with these animals, and our doctors don't have that train of thought usually, and we need to make sure that we are self-advocating in those situations. It's extremely important that we let people know this stuff.
So let me take you to our other website, which is called petdisealerts.org. Okay. So this is where we forecast. So on this website, we've got a couple of things. One is we have alerts, we have forecasts, and we have a fleet forecast. So I'm going to show you the alert maps first. Okay. So this is just a rolling 30 days. This is the last 30 days. This is where the cases of influenza have been in the United States. And I can get it down to the county level. So Brad Hamilton County in Tennessee, or go back to you go to North Carolina, it shows you Wake County, Moore County, there's been cases of canine influenza. You can sign up for these alerts and we'll send you a text or an email when there's positives in your county. It's an engagement strategy. Okay. It's a forewarning system here, early warning system.
Yes.
We do it for lepto as well. And so if we look at the last 30 days, there was only four states in the United States that didn't have cases of lepto, a zoonotic disease, in their state.
Wow.
Right.
That is really terrifying.
Right. Lepto should be a core vaccine. In fact, I think ACVIM just came out and said, I think they've made a position statement to make it a core vaccine. I have always considered leptospirosis one of the core vaccines that we should be doing. So that's alert maps. Okay. We also have forecast maps. So we've been forecasting now since 2015, and our forecasts are 94% to 99% accurate. So we do parasite forecasts. It's for the next 30 days. And so you said you're in South Carolina?
South Carolina. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So whereabouts in South Carolina?
I live in Horry County, right there on the beach.
Right there,
that yellow one.
So your forecast for the next 30 days is a high forecast for heartworms, which is typical for this time of year.
It is. Okay.
because it's not cold enough to get rid of all mosquitoes, and right. mosquitoes live in microclimates. And so we're able to forecast with 94 to 99% accuracy that you still have a high risk. So when clients come in and go, oh, the weather's getting cold, it's getting close to winter, we don't need to be on our preventives anymore, you can say, let's see what the experts are forecasting. Mm-hmm. Right? So we forecast heartworm, we also forecast the various tick-borne agents as well. So I can look at Lyme disease, and so I go to Pennsylvania, and we can see that the state of Pennsylvania has a high forecast, which is lower than this time of year normally, right? Yeah. And so when people say, well, there's snow on the ground outside, well, if it's over 37 degrees out, ticks are active, and the ticks that carry Lyme are still spreading Lyme disease yeah. in your area. We do it for anaplasts. And look at that. Look at the forecast for anaplasma.
Oh, whoa.
State of Pennsylvania. High forecast, which is higher than usual at this time of year. And ehrlichiosis is a medium risk, which is typical for this time of year, as the various ticks are moving, right?
Yeah. Wow.
So we've taken the onus off the veterinarian. You know, so instead of you feeling like, oh, the client's gonna just get mad at me and just say, you're just trying to sell me more product.
Right.
No, let's refer to what the experts are forecasting. What the real risks are.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is just so helpful. And I don't know how I discovered it. I think I actually went to a class that you gave a couple of years ago at VMX. And I came home and I just started roaming around in here going, oh my gosh, this is so helpful. And I think it's just one of those things that's below our radar, and it should not be, because it is so incredibly impactful and really a helpful tool for us to do show and tell. It is just as good as having a heart in a jar, right? I used to love having a heart in a jar that had heartworms. And look at this, because people don't know. You know, it's funny that we are talking about this, because yesterday one of my clients said, can you please get on our phone system? And they have Weave phone system, so I could listen to the recorded calls. And I listened to a very experienced CSR book an appointment for a dog neuter, and they were booking till March. So they're still very busy. But she said to the client, do you want to have him tested for heartworms? Do you want to have pre-surgical blood tests? Do you want to this? And I thought, well, the client doesn't even know what the importance of that is. And you're just going down this checklist, and he's going, no, thinking, oh, each one of those things is going to cost me more money, instead of saying to him, hey, you know what? There's a really high incidence of Lyme disease. We really need to test your dog, and we'll test for that. And do you know, our practice owner got Rocky Mountain spotted fever last year. So we really need to test this dog and keep you all safe. So it's really so important that our team members are taught appropriate pitches, as you said, these scripts that they need to use on the phone. And no matter how busy you get, you can't neglect doing that, because it is really, it could be a matter of life and death in these animals or in the humans that live in those homes, especially if they're somehow immune compromised or elderly or frail, to get these infections could be really life-threatening. So it's important for us to understand the difference and to be able to use these tools for show and tell, and to make a little more effort to talk to people about why they need to do these things, not just, check the list off as I'm going down.
And, you know, at the end of the day, make a recommendation.
Yes.
Your pet needs this.
Yes.
You know, I also like using leading questions.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ones I taught my staff to always use was ask the client, what's your tolerance to fleas and ticks? And the answer is always none. I hate them. Well, right. Then we recommend put in the whatever product you want. Yeah. We recommend you use this. You won't have fleas and ticks.
That's a great question. What's your tolerance to fleas and ticks? Because nobody wants those. And, you know, I've practiced long enough and talked to clients long enough to know from the days before we had monthly preventatives, or the ease of 3-month preventatives that we have now. And people absolutely do not want fleas and ticks in their house. And we have a way to make that not happen. And so that's the question. You know, the other good question is, when people ask, is your cat an indoor cat? And they go, yes. The question really should be, how much time does your cat spend outside of the four walls of your house?
Correct.
90% of the time might be inside, but 10%, is out on the deck. And there's
how many times a day do you take your dog outside?
Yeah, right. Or have you Have you ever had a mosquito in your house? You know, because like I had one in here this morning and it is going to be 30 degrees tonight. So the mosquitoes are, they're
It's a reason the mosquito's inside and not outside, right? Because
right.
they know it's going to be 30 degrees outside tonight.
They've moved inside. Exactly. Yeah. So all these things are so important for us to teach our teams. You know, I do feel almost bad for the teams now because we have so much to talk about. And when you were practicing, Craig, tell me a little bit about how you manage to talk about everything. Because if you think about all the things we talk about, behavior, we talk about food, we talk about parasites, we talk about vaccines, we talk about, the ticks moving into our areas that haven't been there before. And then, of course, there's so much misinformation that we were working to overcome. That's the other thing I think is much more of a challenge than it was back 80s, 90s, 2000s. We are dealing with vast amounts of just garbage information. How are you talking to veterinarians about working through that? And, vaccine hesitancy is another big one that we're dealing with now. What are your coaching advices
Well,
for?
talking to clients, I think that to deal with that first, but I used to use a lot of checklists, keep myself on track. And you use them enough, you get to the point you don't need them, right? It's all about, there's a reason a Big Mac tastes the same whether you buy it in New York, LA, Munich, or Russia, right? It's a formula, it's all done the same way every time. And I always coach my veterinarians that you do the same exam the same way every time. And that way you don't miss things. You take the same history the same way every time. That way you don't miss things. And initially, if you need to use checklists to do it, do it. But then it gets just be second nature for you. So you're asking the same questions and you've got to work out what those questions are. And it's going to be around, the parasite discussion and the dentistry discussion and the nutrition discussion and everything like that. And, but then dealing with the misinformation, you've got to ask those open-ended questions. Tell me why you would have chosen a raw diet. And, it helps you to then understand what their mindset is because you've got those certain clients that you will never change,
No,
right? But you've got the ones that have got the misinformation that you can just gently sort of say, well, if you, I've got some studies here that are actually peer-reviewed control, peer-reviewed studies that actually will explain this better for you. That if you'd like me to share it with you, it what your understanding of it is actually some misinformation I'd like to correct for you if you're open to it, and you can swing them around.
It's always value, saving.
You do it gently in a nice way. I never, never diminished the value of Google because who doesn't use Google? You're right, you have to acknowledge it, you have to accept it, but you have to direct them,
Yes,
you
because
know.
there's really valid information there. And I tell a story all the time that my mother was diagnosed with something called polymyalgia rheumatica. And we had gone to a couple of rheumatologists and she was misdiagnosed, but I had found it because it has a very distinct symptom, which is this, you get redness on your scalp. Well, her hairdresser kept telling me she had these red splotches. And I started to look at the College of Orthopedic Surgeons information on the website and on Google and found this very distinct information piece. This is what I really think it is. And of course, I take it to the doctor. I go, I know you hate it because we hate it too in vet med, but I think you need to look at this. And of course, he immediately discounted it. And it was another rheumatologist who found it and said, yeah, this you were right. So I kind of look at it like this way. Our clients have one or two pets to research, and we have 4,000. And so don't discount their research and appreciate the fact that they want to learn. And I think Marion von der Linde used to have that best line. She said, I'm so glad you want to learn. Let me show you some more things, some maybe more valid things, some more peer-reviewed things, because learning is what these people are trying to do. They want to be good pet parents, and we should not get, our backs all in uproar because they question.
Right, exactly. And along those type of lines too, is the other things I always teach my teams is celebrate the negative. You know, I hear professors tell me all the time, well, you know, we run the vector-borne disease test or the test or parasite screen, and we just tell the client that if you don't hear from us, it's negative. I'm sorry, they just paid money for that test. They deserve an answer, right?
Yes.
They deserve a text, an email, at least as a minimum. But I tell them, you know, and you don't have to do it. Your text will do it. Your assistants will do it. But celebrate the negative. Well done. Your vector-borne disease test was all negative. Continue using those preventives because that's why it's negative.
That's right. Keep doing what you're doing.
Don't devalue your preventives that are protecting these pets. And we tend to devalue them every day. And along those lines, I get tired of people telling me, you know, hearing veterinary staff and veterinarians talk about asking clients, do you have enough heartworm preventive? Most of these are multi-parasite preventives. The last time I sold heartworm preventive was 1985. It was called Filarabits. And the next year they came out with Filarabits Plus that prevented heartworms and hookworms. You know, now I recommend a broad spectrum monthly parasiticide that prevents, and I tell them what it prevents.
Yes.
I show them the value of these products because they're not cheap.
No, they're not. But, you know, it's cheaper. Going back to, you know, historical knowledge is I can remember my clients spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars having flea bombs in their house or treating their dogs for flea allergy dermatitis or the process of treating it for some kind of tick-borne disease is very expensive. So it's just preventative care and having clients understand they don't want their animals to suffer. And we can stop any suffering. This is a great way to stop suffering and to keep your house clean with no bugs. Everybody hates bugs in their house. And to keep your pets healthier and your family healthier, too. It's the other thing. One of my favorite show and tell pictures, and I actually think I put it in my book, is the ocular larval migraines picture from the CDC of this child's eye when you can see that little parasite in the iris of the eye. That is very impactful because people don't know that people can get these diseases. And, you know, sometimes we don't teach enough. And then I go, we don't have time a lot of times to do all the teaching, but there are tools in place. We can share information. We have things that you guys have created here at CAPC.
And you've got a wonderful staff. You just train them well and turn them loose. Because I tell you what, in a lot of clinics, the staff have a closer relationship to the client than the veterinarian does.
100%.
And we don't leverage our staff.
Yes.
And the staff are yearning for knowledge and they're yearning to help these clients.
Yes. Yes.
We just have to get out of their way and let them.
Mm-hmm. I used to teach the Patterson communication class, and I said to the veterinarians attended, let me tell you that your receptionist can shoot you in the foot in a heartbeat with a client because they can change your recommendation for some kind of special shampoo to say, well, you know, it's cheaper at PetSmart. You can just go down there and get it. And as someone who sits in the lobby, I have heard that said. So the goal is, you know, teaching our staff to value the products that we have, to value the recommendations of our doctors, and to support those with the clients. Because you're right, a lot of them, especially your CSRs, have three encounters for the client for every one that the medical team does. And they have more time to just chit chat and build those relationships when they do it right than a lot of times the medical team has available to them. So leverage that, because I can tell you that my front desk was much, much better at selling preventative products, special shampoos, diet than any of my medical team. They just supported it, but then they owned it. They owned it. It was their thing. And people appreciated it because they could spend the time to do it. And it is, but then there's technology now that's coming out that's going to enable us to send information out to clients, just combing through our PIMs, putting documents in a text message and sending them to them. Here's some education. But we lay the groundwork in the practice that, hey, I'm going to send you this really cool piece of information. You need to read it. And it will tell you all about this problem that we're talking about with your pet. And we don't have to do it all. We have tools that we can utilize digitally to support what we start. And then, because people, only remember 10% of what you're telling them in the exam room anyways. Too much information going on there, right?
Right. That's right.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, Craig, this is fun. I'm sure we could talk about this stuff forever and ever and ever. I want to talk just a touch about your facilitation with VMG and kind of talk a little bit about VMG and how it works, because if people aren't familiar with it, I am a huge advocate for independent practice ownership. Yep. And I feel like VMG is such a structure.
It's support for the independent practice. So veterinary management groups is what it's called, VMG.com. And so it is its own company, and the purpose of the company is to support the private practitioner. And so the best thing I ever did as a veterinary business owner was to join VMG. Mm-hmm. Because we are not taught much about how to run a business when we're in vet school. In fact, zero, right?
Right.
Some courses now teach a little bit, but very little. And so you're learning from either buying a practice or starting a practice, and you're just learning as you go. It's just a, you know, steep learning curve. What VMG does is that you join VMG and you join a group within VMG. So there's about 20 veterinarians, or they have some blended groups where it's veterinary and practice managers together. And so you're all in it. You're in a group together. You're under antitrust laws. You're under complete confidentiality laws. And so everything you share within that group stays within that group. And it's like having your own board of directors. So it's complete open book. It's complete honesty. And you're bearing your soul. It's just good, the bad, the ugly. And you've got this group that you can depend on that's got your back, that you're not out there feeling like I'm just alone in this big wide world trying to fuddle my way through this. If I've got a question, I've got people that can give me answers. I can lean on them. They can lean on me. I may throw a question out of the group and you don't get 20 answers, but you may get, you may throw a question out. I'm looking at doing this, or I'm looking at buying this piece of equipment, and you may get 3 or 4 answers from the group. And one person may say, I bought this piece of equipment. It's a lemon. It's terrible. It doesn't meet expectations. Don't buy it. And you go, oh my goodness, that's the one I was looking at, right? And then you get, or you look, work on a program, and you get 2 people say, I did it this way. Don't do it this way. That doesn't work really well. Do what Joe did. And Joe chimes in and goes, yes. And here's, I've got it all written out for you. Here's how I did it. So you're not reinventing the wheel.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. And we have 2 meetings a year for each group, and it's you just got different meeting themes. It may be on HR, it may be on advertising, it may be, who knows. It's not about the practice of veterinary medicine. It's about the art of veterinary business. And then on top of that, the VMG, the company, negotiates contracts with all the different vendors so that you get discounts that are the best in the industry if you're not Mars Pet Care.
Mm-hmm.
And so that at the end of the day, you're running a more profitable practice. You're running a better practice. You've got happier staff. At the end of the day, you can retire in dignity, but your staff can all retire with dignity because you're making enough money for them to do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's what it's all about. It's just a great organization. And so, my recommendation is if you're a private practice owner, you should be part of VMG.
Yeah. Of course, I've known about VMG for a very long time. When I was growing up, Owen McCafferty was our consultant. And so I learned the Owen McCafferty way to practice veterinary medicine business. But the other point I think I want to make with the VMG stuff is it's not people who are like all in your local town. These are people from all different areas, so that you are not, these are not your competitors.
You're under antitrust laws, so you can't be closer to, I think, than about 20. You can't have a practice in your same BNG closer than 25 miles from you.
There you go.
So it's outside of your business, immediate
outside
business.
Outside of your business. Most veterinary business, unless you're a large animal, is what, about a 5-mile radius, is about as far as your clients are willing to travel to come to a veterinary practice. And of course, some of the rural practices are 100 miles. I've done some work in Colorado, and there's like, that's their call radius is 100 miles. Like, whoa, I was thinking like 30 for North Carolina vets, but it's a long way out there to get to almost nowhere. But so I will encourage people, if you have questions about VMG, about CAPC, we're going to, put Craig's information here. And I'm certainly willing to answer anything that I can from my standpoint of communication training. And I just encourage you guys to use these tools, CAPC, VMG, if you're an independent practice owner. I think one of the challenges that independents now have that they have not had in the past is there are so many corporate groups who are negotiating large quantity inventory deals that you cannot do alone. And having the power to negotiate large quantities within the group is incredibly important because, you know, pennies make a difference these days. And we're struggling.
It's the only way you can compete. And, you know, if you saw the news today, Chewy just announced they're opening their first Chewy vet center.
Yeah, I actually
had
information about that and knew it was coming. So, yeah.
And so, you know, I've been saying it for a while. It's just a matter of time before Chewy starts opening vet clinics. And sure enough, here they are.
Yeah. And we have to understand that Chewy lost about $58 million last year. So they are backed by so much private equity money. They are not having to make a profit yet. And they are not making a profit at this point in time, looking at
it's all about grabbing market share.
It is. They're following an Amazon model, which says, let's don't make money. Let's just grab the audience. And then once we have the audience, then we will start to be more profitable. And that's where they're going with this stuff. So I feel like we need to look at, there's an independent practitioners association that I encourage practitioners to join. Obviously VMG has a buying group and the support that hospital owners need to flourish in this profession. As someone who has been in a long time, Craig, tell me what you see are one of our biggest problems in veterinary medicine is at this moment.
Leadership or lack thereof. And it's we're starting to see veterinarians moving out of the not wanting to work with the corporates anymore, wanting to move back in small animal into the private practices because there's better leadership there. But it's the lack of leadership that's creating so many crises, I think.
I agree. I think looking at the problems that everybody is talking about toxicity, burnout, compassion fatigue, all those things, going back to what we started with, it's a communication problem. And that communication has to do with leadership because leaders are the ones who lead the communication in a practice, and they need to understand how to do it well in order to give that team the support and the space and the safety to feel comfortable in their job, to make mistakes without having the sky fall, without constantly being afraid somebody's going to yell at them or fire them, and to not be constantly driven by nothing but numbers and more for purpose, and teaching us to look at that big picture. So, well, I think on that note, maybe we should close because we have taken up our hour of time. So thank you very much for joining me today. And maybe we'll get you back. We'll take some more time. We'll talk about some more stuff. But for the audience, Craig's information will be in show notes. We're both here to help. We're all in for the independent practitioner. And I thank you again very much for visiting with us today on The Bend.
Dr. My pleasure. Thanks, Debbie.
Thank you.
Cheers.